I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This one, in the dying days of the second term of the second President Bush, is with the writer Russ Baker. The extended argument of his engrossing book titled Family of Secrets is that through these last 28 years, 20 of them in which George Bush, father or son, held the highest office in the land, we have barely known who, in fact, the Bushes really are, and that a great deal of what we've swallowed of their story is not true. Russ Baker, I find this an astonishing book. As a journalist and as a citizen, my first reaction was, now you tell us, after the horses are out of the barn. Second reaction is, but wait a minute, we never really believed that they were compassionate or conservative or real patricians or real Texans, for that matter. My third reaction is, how could it be that the political Bushes and we the people conspired somehow in what feels now like a mass delusion? I want you to cut to the chase and tell us who the Bushes really are, Russ Baker. But first, just tell the listeners that you are not Russell Baker, the beloved ex-columnist in the New York Times.
Indeed, I am not. There are frequent mix-ups on that front. I'm a great admirer of his work, and I like to dabble a bit in humor myself. I actually wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times some years back called I'm the Other Guy, and I explained how I get his mail, and whenever he gets a small check, he assumes that it's for me. Basically, I've been an investigative journalist for a little more than two decades, writing for small and large magazines, newspapers, and also doing some television, radio for outlets here in the States and around the world.
Okay. Let me just say, I take this as a book of political inquiry, not political attack, although it's clear you don't much like the Bushes. Tell us, who are they really?
I didn't know who they were, and that's why I embarked on this book. I began in 2004. I'd been living in the former Yugoslavia, where I had been asked to go to train journalists there in how to do investigative reporting about abuses of power and about their own governments. And with all the very apparent deception surrounding the Iraq war, people everywhere I traveled were asking me, well, what about your own country? How did you get the leadership you have? And what are you folks doing to try to get some answers? And I realized we weren't doing a very good job. And when I got back in 04, I began with no agenda at all, simply traveling around the country asking people, who is George W. Bush? How did he rise to this most powerful position in the world? And what does this mean, if anything? And I was prepared to find out that it didn't mean anything, that this was just happenstance, that things just happen the way they happen.
Take the story as it's been presented, that George W. Bush, for example, president for a few days longer, is a kind of West Texas evangelical Christian Republican conservative who, by other lights, is a kind of Denny Dimwit out of the old cartoon, but a guy who never did terribly well at Yale or the Harvard Business School, but is managing as best he can on behalf of the conservative side of our political spectrum. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, what's wrong with that is the whole idea of sort of treating him as a joke, I think, is a grave mistake. I interviewed lots of people who know him, people who worked very well with him, and a lot of people who are not well known. And the clear impression that I got is that this is not an unintelligent man. He is admittedly lazy. He has short attention span. I think he's got some what you might call learning disabilities. But the fact of the matter is that he's fairly bright and he's extremely calculating. What he has done, I think the most brilliant thing in the propaganda arena that the Bushes have done is they created all these false constructs very deliberately. And in the book, in Family of Secrets, I actually interview these people and they tell these stories. Just for example, it's become an article of faith that Bush was reborn as a fundamentalist Christian. And this is very, very important. And this bought him a tremendous amount of leeway because people would say, well, he really believes he's doing the right thing. This was crucial to his success. And in fact, I was able to interview the man who was their point person, the person who wrote them the memos before George W. Bush ever supposedly embraced this new belief. And he actually wrote them memos telling them of the importance of doing this and why this was so crucial in a country where the religious right was just growing by leaps and bounds as a political force. So I saw this again and again. Bush's ghostwriter writing a book with Bush in 1999. Where,
this is Mickey Herskowitz?
Mickey Herskowitz, right. And Mickey, who has a long track record of ghosting books with everybody from Mickey Mantle to John Connolly to Dan Rather. And Mickey, very friendly with the Bush family, gets this book deal to write a book with W. And W really tells him the only thing he cares about, he wants to know how much money he gets off the deal. They start working on the book, and he's asking him, what do you want to do in the White House? And or what have you done? You know, what are the things we can talk about as far as your biography? And he says, well, there really isn't a lot to say. Let's skip that, which is kind of extraordinary because he's now running for the president of the United States. But then he goes on and he says, well, then what do you plan to do in office? And he says, well, talk to Carl about that. And, you know, he had in his mind just a few very key concepts that he needed to be seen as a commander in chief, that it would be advantageous. This is, I think, a major revelation in the book. He told Mickey Herskowitz that one thing that was very foremost in his mind was that if he had the opportunity, he intended to invade Iraq. Now, his notion on this was that this was very important politically, that he had been told you could not have a successful presidency without winning a war. And he felt that his father had maybe made a mistake in not going all the way in the Gulf War. And that they looked at these small wars like the Falkland Islands, where Maggie Thatcher's stock just went way up and she was being showered with flowers and so forth. And they all felt, and, you know, Reagan with Grenada, I mean, they all, Poppy Bush had Panama, you know, they all had managed to be able to wear the mantle of a commander-in-chief. So George W. understood these kinds of things.
Russ Baker, I find it fascinating that you started thinking hard about who the Bushes are when you were in the former Yugoslavia. You were looking from abroad and asking yourself, as you were being asked, who are these people and what do they represent? I see it sort of the other way. If the Bush family or something like it took over China or Zimbabwe, we would see it quite differently from afar. I mean, apply what I would call a Zimbabwe test. If in 2000, say, Zimbabwe chose as its president the son of a former president who had also been the chief of national intelligence, but to get elected had relied on the contested outcome of a province, call it Florida, that was run by his brother, and had relied ultimately on Supreme Court votes by judges that his father had appointed, we would recognize it, as I say, from afar, as something other than democracy at work.
Christopher, I think that's an excellent analysis. If you simply examine the way that major U.S. media cover events involving powerful people in this country and powerful people in other countries, you will see a completely different approach. There are routinely articles in the paper not labeled as analysis or anything with a very rather bracing critical assessments of foreign leaders. They don't hold back at all. And whenever it's the president of the United States, there's a certain reserve, a certain respectfulness, a certain restraint where it's just not possible to go there. And so, yes, we have to – if you want to know what's happening in the United States, you have to read a paper like The Guardian in Britain because they don't hold back.
Yeah, we tend to cover politics, and I speak, you know, as one of the guilty ones, I suppose, in terms of personality and twitches. You know, George H.W. Bush likes pork rinds or doesn't or drives a speedboat, but not in terms of power or what they're actually doing or where they come from. Come back to the main thrust of this book. Well, there are two of them that I'd like you to deal with. First, that George H.W. Bush has been in the intelligence business, the CIA, virtually all his adult life.
Sure. The conventional wisdom is that George H.W. Bush became CIA director in 1976 and served 1 year being a neophyte, knowing nothing about intelligence, and then that was it. In fact, I have documents that I include in Family of Secrets which show a connection to the intelligence service going way back in the 60s, around the time of the Kennedy assassination. There's a crucial memo from J. Edgar Hoover penned the day after the assassination. It's directed to two people in the intelligence community. One is George Bush of the CIA. They tried to put forward another man named George Bush, who had a very low-level position in the CIA at the time. He says it was not him. He even wonders what he was doing there. They hired him for a few months during this period around the assassination. He had no authority of any kind there, and then he left the agency. They also, but that's 63. Now let's go all the way back to 1953, where as a very young man, George H.W. Bush started an oil company, and I found declassified memos indicating that one of his business partners, Thomas J. Devine Jr., was a young CIA officer who, quote unquote, resigned from the agency to go into the oil business with Bush. Now, these resignations of people they've just spent millions of dollars training are not resignations at all. And Howard Hunt did the same thing. It's a very common tactic when they supposedly go into what they really do is go into a private business that is basically a cutout for the agency. So what you see there is you see him involved with all these operations. He's got a tiny company. It's not profitable. He has a handful of offshore rigs. He's traveling constantly to the most exotic places all over the world. And you can see that it is not about the oil business. So he's deeply involved in this stuff. He puts rigs off of Cuba when they start targeting Castro. It's all there. It's very, very clear what he was doing. And the significance of this is that we elected to the presidency of the United States of a man we did not know. We elected basically a Putin. We elected somebody who was working for these sort of shadowy forces, and we never came to terms with that.
That's the way I read your book, but in a funny way, I've been suspecting it for many years. You know, in my time at the New York Times Washington Bureau, I once wrote a Man in the News profile of George Herbert Walker Bush, and I even then sniffed something funny, and I'm very proud that I got a little bit of the suspicion into the paper. The lead on that story was, on my story, was that in the case of George Herbert Walker Bush, it has often seemed that nothing succeeds like failure. And the point was simply that so many things in his life before that moment when he was appointed Nixon's last chairman of the Republican Party, so many things had gone wrong. He left Zapata at the wrong time. He flunked the political test in Texas. He failed Nixon's hope specifically to defeat the Democrats in Texas, and he led Nixon to adopt and convert the top Democrat, John Connally, instead. And then at the UN, as Nixon's ambassador, Bush had failed his main assignment, which was to keep China out of the Security Council. And he was then appointed ambassador of all places to China, where Henry Kissinger ignored him, thought he was a lightweight. But he kept failing upward. Even then, 35 years ago, it was a mystery to me. But it seemed to me the real story was precisely what you have documented so extensively, that the man's success is an utter mystery.
Well, it's not an utter mystery. What it is this. This is a man who is basically on assignment, and his assignments are not our assignments. So when he gets sent – and I go into this in detail in Family of Secrets. When he – there's a chapter specifically focusing on this. When he goes to China, he's not going because he's a China hand. There's actually an excerpt from a conversation with Gerald Ford where he's ushered into Ford's office just before he leaves for China. And he says to Ford, "Don't ask me about China." And he sort of laughs, saying, "I don't know anything about this." And when he goes to the UN, he says – a friend of his says I can't say it on the radio – "What the blank do you know about foreign policy?" And he says, "Ask me in 2 weeks." The inside joke was he's not supposed to know about any of these things, and he's not even supposed to be competent at them, because that's not why he's there. He's there as this inside man for these figures in the intelligence community. And you asked me earlier, what is this really about? This is really about these elites we're talking about. Specifically, what they are is most of them are old families. You know, we talk about us being a country of immigrants, and people like to claim that, you know, the Jews control Hollywood and this and that. But the fact of the matter is, most of the people in this book, most of these people surrounding the Bushes are old line blue bloods. And there are people who are socially connected. They made their money off of resource extraction, oil, gold, sulfur, all of these things. And they have these giant companies that we don't even talk about or know about that to this day run vast mining operations all over the world, tussling with the Chinese and the Russians and so on for control of, you know, titanium mines and what have you. This is the stuff that goes into our Walkmen and our toasters and everything, but we don't understand any of that. But that's really the power on this earth is the power to control energy, precious metals, and things like that. And these guys have always been about controlling that. And the way they do it is they put their people in as CIA director, as number two at the agency, as a key national security advisors, as staff people to the congressional committees that are supposed to be overseeing all these things. And so they very readily convince one president after the other. Virtually every American president has agreed to some extent to intervene in other countries with covert operations and overt operations that defend these interests, supposedly in the service of the American people. And they do that everywhere. And I think one of the main revelations of Family of Secrets is that they seem to do it in this country as well, except they bury it much, much deeper.
Take one story that we don't know well enough, and that is the case of Harkin Oil. Can you treat the Harkin case as a sort of study of the whole story?
To some extent. Basically, to really understand George W. Bush, you have to understand that this effort to try to make him seem to be a rebel and very different from his father was deliberate. That was a calculated effort to make him electable. In fact, the apple fell very close to the tree. He was very much a part of this sort of Bush resource extraction intelligence apparatus. And we see this in many of the companies with which he was involved. I take the reader through a number of these companies, and every single one of them had some kind of intelligence component. There were always sort of Saudis, people connected to Ferdinand Marcos, the South African apartheid regime, putting money in that they lost into these unprofitable ventures. The most interesting of all is called Harkin Energy. And this is a company, a young Bush, George W. Bush, had an oil company. It failed. It was subsumed by a larger company that paid him off very handsomely, gave him a title as chairman. That company failed. It was taken over by this small company called Harkin. Now, Harkin had been taken over by a rather mysterious man, a lawyer in New York, whose father was very, very close with the Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos. And all of these millions of dollars poured in from offshore. This company was never profitable. They brought George W. Bush in. They bought out his company. They put him on the board. And what I do is I go into great detail. I tell the whole story of this company with the most amazing cast of characters and what appears to be some kind of a play involving gold reserves in Asia and the use of the companies basically to wash enormous amounts of money. You have no idea where it came from, where it went to. But Harkin was never profitable. It had this cast of characters that was from kind of an A to Z of Swiss banks and Saudis and what have you.
Not
and
to mention
George
the
Bush in the middle of it.
Not to mention the Harvard endowment. I mean, that played a significant part in keeping that company alive, did it not?
That is a tremendous sub-story. Harvard's endowment, I believe the wealthiest of any of the universities, put the largest single investment they'd ever made into this little podunk, unsuccessful company with George Bush involved there. They put in about $50 million. It's a big mystery why. I get into that. And in Family of Secrets, I tell the whole story, and I actually trace it back to the most powerful person on Harvard's board, who turns out to be, again, an oil intelligence man connected to the Bushes, connected to this whole apparatus. Somehow he managed to get Harvard to move vast amounts of money into something that, as best as I can tell, is some kind of funder of foreign offshore covert operations and money laundering.
This was Robert Stone. Did we ever find out why? Was he ever held accountable for this?
He was never held accountable. The Boston Globe made a good start at this, and they got as far as asking whether he had a role in it. He said he didn't. And as you'll see in Family of Secrets, I go much further and I show that Robert Stone's father-in-law is Godfrey Rockefeller, and he is He met his wife. He was introduced to his wife by Prescott Bush.
Hmm. The Harvard Endowment had also put big money and eventually lost more than $1 billion in Enron, another piece of the puzzle.
That's right. There are connections between Enron and Harkin, and there are very, very similar patterns. Enron, one of the main pieces of its downfall were these very mysterious separate companies they created to Mickey Mouse around with the books. And Harkin did exactly the same thing. And you also see some of the same characters on the same boards. And in addition to that, you see some of the same people involved with BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was the largest bank fraud in world history.
Mm. This is so fascinating. To me, the business of political journalism is to define and clarify what the power stakes are and who's doing it. But the story as you tell it requires a kind of major redefinition. The Bushes have pictured themselves, especially W, as a kind of inheritor of the Reagan legacy. It seems to me, in fact, he's kind of a child of Nelson Rockefeller – again, combining oil, Wall Street, and the intelligence industry, sort of Rockefeller without the paintings or the noblesse oblige. But it's a very, very different story than they've been telling.
Well, that's right. In fact, your Rockefeller analogy is most keen because, in fact, the Bushes worked for the Rockefeller family. The Rockefellers were patrons, different branches of the Rockefeller family, of Bush's great-grandfather from Columbus, Ohio, and he worked for railroads. And one railroad was staked by one relative of John D. Rockefeller, and then he went into a company that created couplers for railroads, and the main funder of that was another Rockefeller. And very interestingly, when Prescott Bush he was actually brought one of the Rockefellers together with his wife, and they were all at Prescott's wedding. These people were enormously close. You even have, for example, George W., when he was in college, he went to his grandfather's house for Thanksgiving, and he sees walking down the stairs Dwight Eisenhower and Nelson Rockefeller, and he says, wow. And he says, yeah, you know, my father knows some of these people. You know, I mean, they were working for these people.
But it's a major redrafting of the story, it seems to me, that also lets Ronald Reagan off the hook somewhat. I mean, Ronald Reagan was a movie star. He was, turns out, a very interesting, sentimental, but good writer. He believed that conservative Goldwater ideology to the core. But he was also an innocent in the world. He didn't believe in these easy interventions militarily. He was deathly afraid of nuclear weapons. He was not connected to the CIA. And he is not the father of the recent administration.
You know, I'm waiting for the reexamination of the Reagan myth. And there's some new book out, I think, that deals with that. But the thing with Reagan is very interesting is they laughed at him inside and they championed him outside. This was just the way you characterize it. He was a very simple man, and he believed certain simple things. He really was something of a kind of Forrest Gump character. He was a very simple man, and he had his appetites for information and so forth were quite limited. He really sort of lost himself in the reality of the movie, and so he imagined himself in the movie continuously. And he really had a little trouble separating fact from fiction. And so when these sterling ideals were presented to him, they were very appealing. You know, who wouldn't want to be the one to tear down the wall, to end the tyranny of totalitarianism and so on. And so he was a perfect person for them to put into play on these things. But he never, I think, really understood the larger picture and how he was being used. On the other hand, the real operational people were people like George H.W. Bush. I call him Poppy in the book. That's his nickname, and it's easier to distinguish him that way. But Poppy Bush was the inside guy who was really running these things. He claimed he was out of the loop on Iran-Contra. I mean, honestly, how could the recent former CIA director be out of the loop on running crucial covert operations that were being coordinated from the White House. And, of course, he was very deeply involved in them, but he has always been masterful at keeping his fingerprints off things. He even went as far as when he was in meetings, he would sit there and almost say nothing. He would nod or write things on pieces of paper or have already told other people what he wanted them to say. And so he was very, very careful about this. And Reagan was out there as the front man, put out as an idealist who saw a government as something that needed to be shrunken down and so on. And all of those things were true, but it had nothing to do with the reality and with the agenda of the people who were directing things behind the scenes.
Russ Baker, you write at one point, Poppy always had perfect cover, which he did. But I wonder who else in American politics has benefited from that kind of obscurity, who has survived that kind of mystery. As you say, George H.W. Bush is the only modern president who hasn't written a memoir, and he still hasn't. Whom do we hold responsible for this kind of lifelong cover-up, besides the active manipulators of it like Karl Rove? I mean, why cannot the New York Times or the television networks or the American media in general talk about the power stakes in real politics, in real politicians?
Well, speaking as someone who has written both for mainstream places and for alternative ones, I can tell you when I write for the alternative ones, I always feel much less inclined to self-censor. And I think the problem is this. When you work for a major organization that is a profit-making organization and is a part of generally a larger corporation with many different interests, let's say CBS News, part of Viacom with regulatory concerns before the FCC on more profitable parts of the company, they're always looking for tax breaks for their film divisions, all sorts of things. And so they – people who work at these places understand that you can do good work and you can criticize the things that are going on, but you have to do it in very small chunks so you don't upset the apple cart. The bottom line is that all of these places can only survive – when we feel good enough about ourselves and our country to go out and spend $50,000 on that Cartier bauble. If we really start thinking about what you and I are talking about here, we really start becoming deeply alarmed and we don't necessarily feel like playing the game and being part of the system. And I think that all those people, everybody's got to pay their bills. They got to keep their salary. And a lot of it is knowledgeable self-censorship.
I think you're right. I think it goes pretty deep in us. It's not just regulation and intimidation of the news media. It's the fact that we're not really eager to know exactly what's happening. And yet there have been brave people who asked questions and got a lot of the right answers. I wanted to ask you, but on my all-star list would be Richard Ben Kramer, who wrote a marvelous book called What It Takes about the candidates 1988. Molly Ivins was always on the Bush case. I loved her line. She said, "How do you know George H.W. Bush isn't a real Texan?" The answer, real Texans don't use summer as a verb. But then also Dan Rather has to be mentioned as somebody who lost his job for telling uncomfortable truths about the Bushes. But then there's also Kevin Phillips, Nixon's intellectual, who wrote very clearly that about the 2000 ticket. It was the first all-oil ticket in American history, he said. And he wrote about the power of finance. He rather looked down on the Bushes as scramblers around big oil. And he wrote in a miniature version of your book, he wrote that the Bush family notion of democracy is sort of built on the CIA model of what you'd install in some very small and obscure third world country.
I think that's right. And what becomes very discomforting to us is we like to feel that we live in the great – we say this all the time. And when you travel, you don't hear this anywhere else. We always say the greatest country on earth, the American people, the finest people, and so on.
Well, it is, and we are, but not for those reasons.
Well, that's right. It is because you and I are able to have this conversation. And we don't have somebody breaking the door down. But the thing is that in order for us to feel that way, it's easier to focus on things that confirm that and not focus on the other things. And so, for example, we recognize at this point that the United States government has been involved in behind or subsidized efforts, some of them successful, to overthrow democratically elected people in other countries. Now, if we accept that that can be done, and we accept, I think, that that was done often in the interests of American interests, American companies, we should at least be willing to consider that where the stakes are the highest, which is right here at home, this would not be the situation where those same people would say, well, let's just leave that alone and let the average person determine the course of this country.
On your own list, Russ Baker, who do you think of as kind of truth tellers, people who did ask the right questions about the Bush family before you?
I think there are a lot of people. Many of them are folks who worked at major news organizations and
the names
were
and
bounced.
Names.
Well, I mean, I do think Dan Rather is an important figure because you have to remember that prior to this debacle over these documents on Bush's National Guard service, he was demanding answers from the Bushes for many, many years. He was really the only national television figure that I recall doing that, except, of course, somebody like Bill Moyers, who's always done that. But Dan Rather, you know, in interviews with Poppy Bush, you know, pressed him on Iran-Contra and so on, and really got into got into it with him. And so, you know, certainly Kevin Phillips is important. There are lots of good books that have been done. I'm certainly not the first person to do one. I won't be the last. I very specifically try to do something different. Mine is a work not so much of analysis or perspective, but it's a work of investigative reporting. I try to assemble a lot of new information, document it, provide a little bit of context of what I think it might mean. But I really invite the readers to, you know, try to figure out what do they think all this stuff means. Are all of these things coincidences? Is it possible that there could be so many of these disturbing things and that they could all amount to absolutely nothing?
Will we ever come to see this whole period, Russ Baker, in terms of not exactly America held hostage, but America in a fog of control led by a family that representing, above all, the intelligence industries and, as you say, the extraction industries, especially oil?
I think we will see that, but I think it'll be more than just the last 8 years. My sense is that this has been going on for decades. And I think that perhaps the last great period of clarity and courage in this country, a period of any extended length, was FDR's presidency. And, you know, they spoke truth to power. I mean, I quote in Family of Secrets a letter he wrote to one of Wilson's former advisors. And he said, we both know that
the
real power
himself.
FDR, he writes to Colonel House. And he says, you and I both know that the real power in Washington rests on Wall Street. You know, they spoke quite openly about these things. And FDR was quite clever in that he brought in all these different people, including a lot of people who were from these same sort of extraction industries, because he wanted to keep an eye on them. He wanted them under his roof. He did not give them free rein, but he had this sort of vigorous debate going on. He had all the people pro and con in there. It was a very interesting approach. Perhaps Obama will try something like that. But we have been in a fog for a very, very long time. And very interestingly, the Bushes have been involved in that fog all the way through, even when they weren't president or vice president for 20 of the last 28 years. They were doing other things. Poppy Bush befriended Bill Clinton, and they were very, very close. And you see the—
As post-presidents, you mean, yeah.
No. When Bill Clinton was president,
oh.
Poppy Bush was very close with him. And they never said a bad word about each other, continued a lot of similar initiatives to some extent. And if you go further back and you look, for example, at Eisenhower, I mean, Eisenhower was picked to be president by a small group of financiers that were closely tied to Prescott Bush. And Prescott Bush was Ike's golfing partner. Ike didn't really like any of this. And as we all know, when he was leaving office, he finally stood up and did the one really courageous thing where he gave his valedictory address about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. That was a kind of a plea for help almost. Hmm. And then he was silent after that.
Can we hope for a sort of clarification of the stakes and who's in charge, would you suppose, in an Obama regime?
I don't know. I mean, I think we're entering a possibly another period of delusion. People are so tantalized by this man who is clearly very bright and very talented. One of the things that concerns me, and I hear this again and again here in New York where I live, is how many people talk about how they find him attractive. And this concerns me because this was the same thing with John F. Kennedy. You know, these sort of superficial bases on which we're happy with somebody, we're content with them. This, is, of course, is all going in the wrong direction. Maybe what we need, which the Europeans sometimes do, is to find somebody who's, you know, homely and a bit of a curmudgeon or something, but really understands what's going on and is completely fearless in that regard. But I do have to say there are some possibilities and there are some reasons for hope. I think Obama, I don't know how much of what's in the book he understands. I hope that he'll obtain a copy of it. But I think he has a sense, some sense of the difficulties he faces and the very, very subtle pressures that are going to be imposed upon him by these elements that will be done in a way that the rest of us will not see it. So I think he's aware of that. I think he's doing his best to try to set up a structure where he's somewhat insulated.
We're about to find out, and you help raise all of our consciousnesses. Russ Baker, thank you so much for Family of Secrets. Thank you for joining us on Open Source.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, Christopher.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.